From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. More severe storms and tornadoes are likely from the Central Plains to the Midwest later today after tornadoes touched down in the Dayton, Ohio metro area overnight, causing tons of damage, power outages. There have been no deaths reported in the direct area, but one man died northwest of Dayton. Let's bring in Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. Mayor Whaley, I know you're standing at a strip mall. Can you tell us where you are and what you're seeing?
Yeah, I'm just over the Dayton line in Harrison Township, and there's a strip mall that has been completely destroyed. So we've been going through and assessing damage. A lot of our business areas have been hit very hard, and streets that are completely devastated from the tornado last night.
We heard this morning about having to have snowplows out, actually plowing debris off the roads, which is dangerous business with down lines, I would think.
Right. Yeah, we have a lot of people in the county without power, so we're with the police chief right now and heading to see other sites and see if there's anything we can do.
Yeah, the roof of a high school in Brookville ripped off. I'm imagining you're, as horrific as this is, just the damage, I'm imagining you're thinking, maybe thank goodness it was in the evening, fewer people gathered.
Yeah, I think that we're super grateful for that and that people really have paid attention to the warning. So far, we have no fatalities. And as devastating as this tornado was, that's pretty amazing.
Well, I was going to say, do you have people missing? It feels as if it's impossible there couldn't have been more serious injuries or fatalities.
We've had some minor injuries, and people are assessing to make sure their family and friends are okay. But as of now, we have not found any fatalities or anyone missing.
Yeah. Tell us more about what you're seeing. We're hearing words like catastrophic, unbelievable. Can you give us more of a sense of the damage?
Well, it's really like nothing I've ever seen. We just left Kelly Avenue near Troy Street on Old North Dayton, and the entire street is just gone. Parts of the houses just split from the middle, brick houses, split in half. In my lifetime, I've never seen this kind of devastation.
Yeah. Look, what is it that you would like people to know in that area? We know there are some hashtags. There's some advice about, don't call 911, I guess, unless it's very serious.
Right, right. And, listen to local media and follow City of Dayton and Twitter. I think that's the best way to stay in touch and, check on those you love. And, we're also asking people to check on those that are housebound or elderly. And then also we're asking people to conserve water because right now the biggest concern we have in the city is the water plants are without power, which is a big, big problem for us.
So are you asking people to boil water?
Yes, we're under a boil advisory for about 400,000 people right now.
So you mentioned the @CityOfDayton Twitter handle. People should follow that. And there's also a hashtag Dayton Tornado. People want to communicate that way. Look, we're reading about the Action Sports Center. This is 30,000 square foot indoor complex, two full size soccer fields inside, totally ruined.
Yeah, just gone. Yeah. So we went and saw that. Yeah. So people are cleaning up and working. And I think most everybody in Dayton is just really grateful that their families are safe.
Well, and do you have thoughts, Mayor Whaley, on, you say, everyone we're hearing from has said they've never seen anything like this in Dayton. Do you have thoughts on, wait a second, we all know that there's climate change. Do you have thoughts on whether this is something you might have to think more about, this kind of a devastating weather?
Yeah, I think extreme weather is an issue that continues more and more all across the country. And, true enough, in the Midwest, we don't have as much of it as, the coasts do, for example, with the rising ocean. But, yeah, we see, in Oklahoma, you see a tornado every day. And, it makes us, have to be more prepared for disasters.
Yeah. And by the way, what do you need from the state, the federal government? What help do you need?
Oh, the state and the federal government have been helpful. The White House has reached out, as well as the governor. Ohio Task Force One is already on the ground. So, we have these, the way that first responders do so well to always be prepared comes in very handy today.
Yeah. Nan Whaley, Mayor of Dayton, Ohio, you've got a busy day. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too.
Well, the field of Democrats aiming to replace President Trump next year is apparently set. There are now 23, and there's already a question of whether they should appear on Fox News and, more broadly, how much they're doing to reach out to Republicans. Well, Washington Post opinion writer Paul Waldman says that's a standard that Republicans aren't held to. Paul Waldman, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, and explain why you think it's a double standard.
Well, if you look at the way we talk about how Democrats and Republicans are supposed to assemble an electoral majority, Democrats are always being asked if they are properly reaching out to voters who are not inclined to vote for them, doing it in the right way. And there's a kind of an implication there that not only is this what they have to do to win, but it's also almost a moral obligation. Yet somehow we don't talk about that when it comes to Republicans. To just take one example, right now, Democrats are all talking about whether or not their presidential candidates should appear on Fox News, mm-hmm. with the assumption that you have to do that if you want to talk to conservatives, which I don't think is really valid. There are lots of different ways one could talk to conservatives. But anyway, you don't hear that in elections about whether Republicans should be going on MSNBC, mm-hmm. which is not as far to the left as Fox is to the right. It's something that we don't even bother asking with Republicans because they're not worried about doing it. And I think that that probably is a big part of this, that since Democrats agonize about it all the time, we in the media end up asking the question a lot, whereas Republicans don't even bother. So nobody even considers that they might want to reach out more to places where Democrats gather.
Well, do you think that that's a Trump thing or that's a Republican thing that's been going on longer than President Trump?
Oh, I think it definitely predates him. After every election, Democrats ask themselves, you know, do we need to do more to connect with the voters who don't like us, whether it's, you know, working class white men or whoever it is. You don't see Republicans very often talking about how can we do more to reach, say, African-American women. Mm-hmm. But Trump kind of took what Republicans were already doing and elevated it. So he is really focused relentlessly on appealing to his base and doesn't even bother making a pretense that he wants to appeal to everyone else. I think one of the most symbolic examples to me is right after he won the election in 2016, he went on a what he called a victory tour where he just visited the states that he won and ignored states that he didn't win. You know, if Barack Obama had done that, there would have been an outcry, but nobody even noticed when Trump did it because it's just kind of par for the course for him.
Well, and I noticed that as president, the Washington Post just came out with a story the other day talking about where he's been as president. He still has not been to a lot of pretty big states in this country in terms of population. Massachusetts, Washington State, Oregon, Colorado hasn't visited as president, according to the Washington Post.
Yeah, he believes that he won in 2016 by focusing on his base. And I think it's pretty clear that he sees that that's his path to winning re-election, is that if he can just relentlessly focus on the people who are the most committed to him, that's the way for him to win, and he doesn't have to reach out across the middle. And there's something else going on, too, on a policy level that I think you see this contrast. So Republicans, what do they do when thinking about the voters who don't vote for them? Well, they've undertaken a comprehensive campaign of voter suppression. They say, if African-Americans aren't going to vote for us, we're not going to try to persuade them to vote for us. We're going to try to keep them from the polls. Democrats do something very different in policy, I think. For instance, when a Democrat releases an environmental plan, what you always see is an effort to say, okay, we know that coal is disappearing, so we're going to try to help these communities mm-hmm. that have been devastated by the decline of coal. We're going to try to give them job training and economic development, and we're going to try to beef up the safety net to make sure they have health care, child care, and things like that. Democrats know that when they do this, they're still not going to win West Virginia or Kentucky, but they do it anyway. Yet they're always critiqued for not reaching out properly, even though they're the only ones who are actually doing all this reaching out.
Why do you think they do it then? Because there are a lot of people on the left who would say, you know, why should Democrats be spending time focusing on these places? They should go all in with the base of the Democratic Party.
Well, I think there's two reasons why they do that in policy terms. The first is because they just think that it's the right thing to do. You know, when Democrats passed the Affordable Care Act, they wanted to expand Medicaid for everyone, not just in states where there are a lot of Democrats. So that's one reason. And I think the other reason is that they are very cognizant of the fact that they're going to get pilloried in the media if they don't make this kind of attempt. And so they see incidents like, you know, we all remember that time when Hillary Clinton was campaigning and she said, we're going to put a lot of coal companies out of business.
Right.
Well, what nobody remembers is that before and after that particular sentence that perhaps was not phrased in the way she would have preferred, she was talking about how we have to help people in coal communities because it's just inevitable that coal is going to disappear. Yet nevertheless, you know, that part gets taken out of the soundbite. And so I think Democrats look to experiences like that and know that they're always going to get criticized if they're not doing the proper reaching out. You know, often it ends up manifesting itself in ways that are almost ridiculous. You know, the Democrats go to Republican areas and try to, you know, kind of pay tribute to cultural totems. They go hunting. They go to NASCAR events. Nobody even bothers to ask if Republicans are going to try to find the things that liberals like and go to show that they like those things, too. It's just not something that Republicans bother doing.
Well, I remember the context of the Hillary Clinton quote because we did a story about it on this show. So I remember that one very well. Paul Waldman, opinion writer for The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I am walking out in the rain, and I am listening to the low moan of the dial tone again, and I am getting nowhere with you, and I can't let it go, and I can't get through.
Ani DeFranco began singing and playing in local bars in Buffalo, New York, with her guitar teacher when she was 9. By 15, she was an emancipated minor, then became an emancipated artist, founding her own independent record company, Righteous Babe Records. By the 90s, her righteous anger and clear-eyed feminism attracted a fierce following of devoted fans who sang along to songs like Both Hands and 32 Flavors.
God help you if you were an ugly girl. Of course, too pretty is also your doom. Cause everyone harbors a secret hatred for the prettiest girl in the room. And God help you.
Sometimes the fan embrace was too tight. Some punished her for perceived missteps. In a reminder that parts of this conversation may not be for everyone, after Ani sang openly about women she loved, she married, as she put it, a person with a penis.
Please join me in welcoming Ani DeFranco and Robin Young.
Obviously, not all fans felt betrayed. Her book tour is sold out. The Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts was packed. As we sat down with Ani DeFranco to talk about her new coming-of-age memoir, No Walls and the Recurring Dream. The No Walls is the home she grew up in, all open spaces, open minds. Ani, the wildly inventive daughter of a Canadian mom and Italian immigrant dad. But things soon grew dark. We start there. The mother, who's a fierce feminist, starts realizing that at least then that meant she had to work and clean the house. She starts to lose herself. Father loses a job. Brother loses his mind. There are two suicide attempts, your father and your brother. How did that form Ani?
At that time, I felt determined to be happy, to love my life.
Yeah, but before that, you were making the meals at times. Your mother left. I'm wondering if that also fueled your anger, that sense of, wait a minute, you know, what was no walls and fun became no walls and not safe.
Well, yeah, I think that this anger that I was so known for or reduced to or thought of as being this angry chick, I really think that it was my mother's anger moving through me. And anger is not as precise as feminist outrage. But then her energy also was so vibrant. She gave me a lot of the tools that I used.
It sounds like your dad helped with the tools as well. Copeland and John Fahey, both on the turntable.
Yeah.
And I know you don't like to be asked about what your musical influences were, because there's so many. But just to talk about, what were your musical influences?
Robin, I've never been asked that before. This is amazing. Oh, man. Yeah, well, so my father loved music, and because he was an immigrant, he revered American artists. You know, it's my subconscious. I was playing Jazz Fest the other day, and somebody said, "You are so quintessentially American." And I was like, "Yeah, that's what I got made of."
Well, that's so interesting, because I can hear someone else thinking, really? Isn't she the one who shaved her head and she has this gender fluidity? I'm not quite sure, you know, where she is.
Yeah, that became what I was known for instantly. Late 80s, early 90s, you know, a lot of people were still in the closet. I got why they didn't want their whole lives to be reduced to one element, because that is exactly what happened when I wrote songs for women and men, and suddenly it's bisexual singer. Like, oh, okay, I've written songs about a lot of things. They don't say anti-capitalist singer or, you know, and that's to this day.
It's a part of who else you seem to be, which is don't label me. Part of why you started the record company is that you wanted to be outside the music industry and you didn't want it to be about making money. You wanted it to be about your art. But then the fact that you were making money was embraced by everybody as why you were outside the system.
Yeah, why I was special. Oh, oh. That's another story that just was bigger than me. The writers in the media, they would literally ask me every day, so what do you think it is about you that makes you so successful? And it's like, I don't know, dude. I don't know. And if you want to bust out of that frame, you need strength. You need conviction.
Well, you sure do, especially, let's go back to your sexual fluidity. You were embraced by queer women everywhere. Then this embrace became like a stranglehold.
Yeah, well, you know, I feel that if you are not seeing yourself reflected in your culture and affirmed, and it's a human need. So I could feel that on a daily basis. And this role that I was playing, something that I was providing, which is, yes, you're not alone. So for somebody who is finding themselves affirmed for the first time ever, there is a clinging that comes with that. I mean,
and an ownership.
Yeah, pretty quickly I realized, wow, I can't satisfy that person's need for me to be exactly what they need, and that person, and that, you know, because it changes.
You write in the book about going to, is it the Womenkind Festival in Michigan? The beginning of your unease. Your friend had to take off her T-shirt because there was a picture of a male band on it.
Yeah, several of my feminist friends said, you have to take that whole section out of this book. No, I'm telling you, take it out. So forgive me, you know, forgive me if I offend. I went looking for feminist Nirvana, and I found myself miserable, and I was devastated, and I realized, right, the antidote to patriarchy is not matriarchy. That's another rabbit hole. The answer is resonant balance.
But I think you went to a queer awards ceremony, and I think you were booed there. You came out on stage in a dress, and what happened?
Sell out. Yeah, I seem to feel that a lot. People who are in a very tight spot want somebody else in there with them. It could be very punishing, my relationship with my listeners. You know, it's a long-term relationship, and we've been through a lot together, and the whole picture is I have been fed and affirmed and uplifted much more than constricted. The one thing that I was searching for through music was family, because my family sucked, you know? So I went out in the world and I looked for my family and I found them. And of course, family hurts.
And then you married someone with a penis. Is that Little Castles? Is that that paragraph in Little Castles? I've got it here. People talk about my image like I come in two dimensions, like lipstick is a sign of my declining mind.
Yeah, well, that was that time, boy.
And people talk about my image like I come in two dimensions, like lipstick is a sign of my declining mind.
And I felt very claustrophobic.
How, what was it like to sing it?
Oh, geez. I mean, I guess heart racy and screamy and yeah. Yeah. Oh, man.
New sport. Quick, someone call the girl police and file up.
naive. Well, I mean, a lot of it is just the chemistry of youth. And I do find it harder as I get older. I've had experiences more recently in life that have made me feel fear and self-doubt.
What experiences?
Oh.
I think I know, 2015. Yeah.
In 2015, Ani was asked to host a songwriting workshop, which turned out to be in a former manor house of a slave plantation. The backlash from some fans was scathing.
I'm still trying to incorporate that, you know. I would see one of my tribe members, you know, somebody who looked like a feminist. I was so afraid. And it was seismic.
These tears, I'm so sorry.
Oh.
Has writing this, but what has this done?
Well, yeah, you know, I would say that writing this book has made me more grateful. You know, you sort of jot down your memories, and I think a lot of those had a negative. And when I sat down for 2 years and I really thought about it, I realized that's not the whole story.
And it's not written yet. Ani DeFranco.
Every time I say something they find hard to hear, they chalk it up to my anger and never to their own fear. Imagine you're a girl just trying to finally complain, knowing full well they prefer you were dirty and smiling, and I am sorry.
It's 1965. A white minister is murdered in Selma, Alabama, but no one is held to account.
More than 50 years later, we return to the place where it happened, to call a lie, and finally solve this murder.
White Lies, from NPR. New episodes drop Tuesdays.
Here and Now, and the following message, is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
Facebook is facing criticism for its decision to leave up a video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that was manipulated to make her look like she was slurring her words. The video was posted last week by a Facebook page called Politics Watchdog and quickly gained more than 2 million views. While Facebook acknowledged the video is false, it said the video would remain on the platform. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large at Recode and joins us. Hi, Kara.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. So you called Facebook's response to this incident ridiculous and said the company is abrogating its responsibility as the key distributor of news on the planet. Explain why you say that.
Yes, I said that. Well, you know, I just think their response was so inadequate to what's going on. Here's this video that if it's a parody, that's a different story, but it didn't seem to be a parody to start with. And other social media sites like YouTube took it down because it was clearly a false mashup designed to hurt Nancy Pelosi in a way that was just ridiculous. And so, you know, I don't necessarily think they had to take it down, but the way they labeled it and how they handled it just seemed to be, they wanted to have the best of both worlds, not to label it properly or not to take it down. And so that's why I thought their response was ridiculous.
How do they get this right, though? Because they is there a policy about what they decide to take down? They do take things down that pose a threat to public safety.
It's all haphazard. That was my point. But they don't. It's so haphazard the way they did it. In this case, they labeled the video that it was a hoax. But the label didn't say hoax. It just said fact checked, which you had to click in on it. And then they said there's been additional reporting on this. And I don't know what that means. It's just super confusing. And I think it's designed to be confusing. I think I can't think of any other reason you'd be that obtuse about the problems with this video and not at least explain it to people.
I want to focus on another line in what you wrote, which is that Facebook is a key distributor of news on the planet. We don't really think of mm-hmm. it that way, but I guess you're right. It really has become such, and they don't operate like a media organization mm-hmm. does.
No, statistically they are. I mean, statistically they're 100%. I think a half of the people in the United States get their news from Facebook, and in the Philippines and other places, it's much higher. It's like very close to 100%. And so they are partially a media organization in the old sense, and that they distribute media, but they don't take any responsibility for that job. And so they like to think of themselves as a benign platform, but they make all kinds of decisions. They sort of like to think of themselves as like a cell phone network, but they're not. The question is, how much control do they have over these things? And what they tend to do is hide behind this idea of censorship and First Amendment, when in fact they're not the public square, so they can make decisions. They just don't want to make decisions. That's the issue I have.
Kara, it's interesting that we're spending a segment talking about Facebook's response and scrutinizing Facebook's response mm-hmm. to this, and not the fact that President Trump actually tweeted out a video of filled
sure.
with Nancy
well.
Pelosi speaking like this.
You know, that's another issue. Should this be on Twitter at all? Should Twitter be able to do it? But, you know, it really does point to the fact that these social networks do not have control themselves. And, you know, again, of course, President Trump shouldn't have done that. And so he's just being obnoxious, as usual, on Twitter, which is his MO, and he does it quite successfully. He's different to me than the company, which really should at least label it properly if they're going to keep it up. That's it. I just literally that is like the lowest bar you can ask for for this company to do.
That's Kara Swisher, editor at large at Recode. Kara, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
In the legal fight over abortion, the narrative has changed. As anti-abortion activist Jean Mancini wrote in an op-ed in USA Today, her side was often criticized for defending the unborn on religious grounds. Now, she says, science reinforces the notion that the unborn from the moment of conception are persons. The Atlantic quotes young anti-abortion activists who say new technology makes it harder for them to think of the embryo or fetus as unviable. And the article concludes that scientific progress is remaking the debate about abortion, with activists on both sides seeing science as their weapon in a battle over rights. Well, let's take a look, because according to our next guest, the science isn't completely clear. Scott Gilbert is a developmental biologist and professor emeritus at Swarthmore College. Dr. Gilbert, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So take us through this. We hear life begins at conception. When the sperm fertilizes the egg, we're going back to biology class, this creates the zygote. And some people think that that actually deserves personhood. Paul Ryan once backed a bill that would have called for personhood for the zygote. You say what?
Well, one thing I can say with absolute certainty, with no hesitation, is that there is no consensus among scientists as to when human life begins. There are major places where different groups of scientists have claimed humanhood might begin. One is at fertilization. That's where some geneticists have said it was. It's when we get our genome. And this is the type of personhood that is advertised by 23andMe. You are what your genome says you are. Mm-hmm. But as you know, you're much more than your genome. And it is not scientifically true that you become a unique individual there. And many embryologists have pointed out that the zygote starts dividing. And when it divides, it can become twins. Mm-hmm. It can become triplets. The individuality is not set at fertilization.
Well, many of those fertilized eggs don't make it through the rest of the process.
That's exactly correct. If you had 20 sperm meeting 20 eggs, only about 14 will implant into the uterus and start a pregnancy. Of those 14, only 6 will become babies.
There's a wonderful statement by a bioethicist, Michael Sandel. So Michael Sandel said, if the embryo loss that accompanies natural procreation were the moral equivalent of infant death, then pregnancy would have to be regarded as a public health crisis. Alleviating natural embryo loss, he said, would be a more urgent moral cause than abortion, in vitro fertilization, and stem cell research combined.
Because so many embryos are naturally lost.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's another group that believes that, and this is scientists, that life begins around when a successful embryo successfully implants in the uterus. This is around 12 to 14 days in. Another group thinks life starts around week 24 to 28. This is when brain waves can be detected. Tell us more about that thinking.
Sure. The day 14 rule is a kind of unofficial rule in human embryology research that says day 14 is really the last day that you can form twins. Day 14 is when the body parts start being told what they are to become. All these cells are now being told, you're going to be a gut cell, you're going to be a brain cell. So that's the kind of rule that you become an individual about 2 weeks after fertilization. Now, the acquisition of the EEG pattern of brain waves is another very interesting place where a group of scientists have said, this is when humanhood begins. This is when personhood, rather, begins. And this is because the EEG, the electroencephalogram, is considered the prerequisite of consciousness. Now, we are willing to say in the United States that when you see flatlining, when the brain waves disappear, that's death. So it would be symmetric to say that conscious life begins when you acquire that EEG pattern. And that begins around week 26 to 28 weeks.
Yeah.
So we have a situation here where some people say it's at fertilization. Some people say it's at gastrulation when twinning ends. Some people say it's when you acquire the EEG pattern at about 26 weeks. And other people will say it's at birth when you take your first breath and the heart changes.
Talk about that, because this is a group of scientists that think life starts when you take that first breath, because that's when the heart fully forms. They believe it doesn't fully form until then. Which is the
right.
most, of all these that you've laid out, which is the most widely held? Because we don't hear a lot. Many scientists are reluctant to even speak about this because it gets so weaponized by each side.
It gets weaponized by each side, and a lot of scientists will just say it's the wrong question, that there is no one time when you could say for all embryos that before that it's not a person, after that it is a person. So there's this notion of a gradual acquisition, and the notion that many people want to pinpoint a stage, you know, at which personhood begins, probably is a holdover from the belief that, you know, a soul descends upon formerly soulless living stuff, transforming that into person. You know, we want an ensoulment period. And science said, we can't tell you that. That's not what we deal with. And so a lot of scientists remain quiet, I think, because scientists often feel this is not a scientific question.
It feels like at one time it was so much easier because it was thought the quickening was thought to be the time when a mother felt a baby kick. This is around 20 weeks. And that's when it was believed that unborn received a soul.
Right. Animation means, you know, both movement, but also a soul, an animus, a mover.
Huh.
Yeah.
But now expectant mothers can hear a heartbeat or at least some cardiac activity. We know that an embryo does not have a heart, but at 6 weeks you can detect some cardiac activity. They can watch this embryo grow to a fetus on a sonogram. It has certainly changed the way people perceive pregnancies. As we said, anti-abortion activists are seizing on a lot of what this science is showing us as proof that there is life. Scientists, as you say, are not entirely as a group sure.
Right. Nor do many scientists consider it a scientific question.
Yeah.
And but certainly, you know,
to answer the question you brought up originally, is science supporting the anti-choice zygote rights people? Is science supporting them? No. There's no new data that supports such claims. The data is just as equivocal, just as able to be used by anybody as it was before. There is nothing new so far as I know.
Is this a big conversation in your field?
No. I don't think it is. It's certainly not something that comes up at meetings or in symposia. I think that the people who are thinking most about when human life begins are the people who are involved in early pluripotent stem cell research. But in embryology per se, it's not something that comes up in our research agendas very often.
Do you think that should change given the debate over it?
I think that
or is it just unanswerable?
Well, I think that scientists should become aware of the different possibilities if they are not already and be willing to talk about them both in public and to their students. Often this doesn't even get brought up in classes. And I think that's a mistake. I think, you know, it's kind of an immoral act not to teach scientists about the ethical questions in their discipline. The education of scientists definitely should include, you know, questions like, when does human personhood begin? And what are the possibilities now given our better technology?
Professor Scott Gilbert, a developmental biologist and professor emeritus at Swarthmore College and the University of Helsinki. Dr. Gilbert, Scott, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to have been able to speak.
European Union leaders are in Brussels today assessing the results of the European parliamentary elections. The Greens and liberals on the left and nationalists on the right got a boost in the elections at the expense of the big centrist blocs that have traditionally held the majority. In Greece, voters punished the ruling Syriza party, forcing Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras to call for early elections next month. Joining us now is John Syropoulos, who writes the New Athenian blog. He's with us from Athens. John, this is being described as a devastating loss for Syriza. Was it a surprise?
I think many people were not surprised, but they were surprised by the margin of victory of New Democracy. Especially in the last few weeks, the pro-New Democracy media had been downplaying its chances of a convincing win, although they weren't actually denying that New Democracy would win. And that might have been partly because they wanted to dampen expectations and make sure that voters were motivated to go to the polls. But it may also have been that they were genuinely concerned that Syriza, through its last-minute concessions and handouts and tax cuts, was going to actually claw back some of its voters. That clearly didn't happen.
And just describe, for people who are not familiar with Greek politics, these two parties. How far to the left is Syriza and how far to the right is New Democracy?
Well, New Democracy is a traditional center-right party. It's part of the European bloc of European popular parties. Syriza started out in life as a sort of breakaway communist party. Greece also has a communist party, which is Stalinist, and this is why some of its adherents tore away when communism collapsed in 1990, because they wanted something more progressive and more realistic and less Moscow-oriented. They did not ultimately succeed, but they created a party that survived until Alexis Tsipras took it over when it was claiming about 4% of the vote. It was very near the brink of extinction. He took it up to 16, 26, and then 36% of the popular vote, the margin with which he won power in January of 2015, in the space of about 7 years, which was remarkable and attributable to the tremendous crisis that Greece went through, the worst recession of any post-war developed economy.
So what does it tell you now that Greeks have obviously punished this left-wing party? after all the austerity and all the many years of trouble to do with the bailouts, et cetera, what does it tell you that now Greek voters seem to have changed their tune?
I think it's a maturing process. Many people feel that Greeks had to go through this stage, if you like, in politics, of believing that there was an alternative to austerity and having that belief dashed. But don't forget that every political party tried to make political gains out of a national crisis. When the socialists were in power in 2010, it was the conservatives who told them they were doing terrible things to the economy by cutting government spending. The conservatives came to power in 2012, and then they had Syriza telling them that they were doing terrible things that were neoliberal. When the conservatives lost power to Syriza, it was Syriza's turn to succumb to the austerity policies. Because the fact was that when Greece was spending 15.5% of its GDP in deficit, that was excessive. It couldn't afford to borrow that level of money every year to increase its total aggregate debt. That deficit had to be eliminated. It took about 5 years for the budget to be balanced. It happened in 2016, more like 6 years. But it cost popularity to the socialists, who were wiped out as a party. They came to power with 44% of the vote. Now the best they can do is 6 or 7%. And it did tremendous lasting damage to the conservative New Democracy as well. It's now taken its toll on Syriza.
Is the crisis still ongoing in Greece, would you say, economically?
In a sense, yes, because although on the outside the country looks as though it's stabilized, it is repaying its creditors. It is back on money markets. It's borrowing from international markets. It isn't in a shape that is sustainable. For example, a recent study found that 90% of income tax is being paid by one-fifth of individuals, and 80% of corporate tax is being paid by 4.5% of businesses. The economy is underperforming. The growth rate of 1.9% that we had last year and look set to repeat this year isn't enough to revive prosperity and tax revenues after the loss of 26% of GDP over 8 years. Mm-hmm. So it is internally weak. It isn't sustainable. And New Democracy's rise is, I think, thanks to the fact that it has proclaimed it will pay attention to the private sector and the productive economy.
That is journalist John Syropoulos speaking with us from Athens. John, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.